Some FCC forum Q&A will be on its way after 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Will Rogers, K5 WLR, with this rain report. This week we'll revisit the FCC forum recently conducted at the Dayton Hamvention. For some attendees, the Q&A session was more interesting than the scripted talks. Hear what you think. Here is the first of two excerpts from the Q&A session hosted by forum moderator Kurt Bartholomew, N3GQ, from the FCC Public Safety and Homeland Security Bureau, and William Cross, W3TN, from the FCC Wireless Telecommunications Bureau.
In answering your questions, Kurt and I will try and be candid as we can. Obviously, we cannot prejudge what the Commission will do in any particular matter. Kurt left his crystal ball in Washington. Mine broke years ago.
My apartment burnt to the ground this past year, and part of what was happening at that time was there was another significant incident in progress, and whatever the fancy new emergency communication system had become overloaded, shut down. And frankly, you would have been reading about this if I hadn't have been a ham, because I told one of my friends I was having a problem. Several of my friends showed up so that when they found out they couldn't communicate, those guys got hams within a few minutes to every hospital, had a ham at every fire station, found the resources they needed to get on site. They had one ambulance on site with two paramedics, 20 victims, all of which were critical. And so the ambulance guys stabilized people, including myself, and the hams got on the radio, got a whole bunch of people with vans and extra hams, and drove the victims to the hospital because emergency vehicles were not available.
You know, in the Army, we call that being field expedient. Good job.
That example brings up a very important part about emergency communications. It's something that is as difficult for the public safety community as it is for the amateur community. You know, we talk about emergencies. We have a huge infrastructure that we've invested in with, you know, things, equipment, people, training, all that kind of activity. We have the hams. We talk about emergency communications as one of the purposes of amateur radio, which it is, and it's a very important purpose. But no one bothers to tell us in advance what the emergency is going to be. So we're confronted many times, both on a public safety side and a disaster response side and the amateur side, with exactly that situation. You have some resources available. They may be in the wrong place. You may not be able to communicate with them. And in many cases, they aren't enough. So you have to think about the emergency providers, the first responders. What are they preparing for? If it's a small town in the Midwest that has one industrial plant there, they're preparing for something different than a small town that's primarily a residential area that has farms surrounding it, a central business town, things like that. And then there are some emergencies that, for instance, the 9/11 event, you had three different emergencies in three different places, all related, but in a sense all independent too. Think about what was involved. The Public Safety Response Force in Washington, in total, was overwhelmed with what was going on at the Pentagon. The New York people were completely overwhelmed with what's going on in New York. And the group in Pennsylvania had a plane crashed in the field with many casualties there in what is a rural area. One of the biggest dilemmas that faces the public safety community is, what do we plan for? And no one knows, because you can have, in a small community, an emergency, a situation develop. It may be a derailment of a freight train coming through the town that has chemical tank cars on them. You got to look at those cars. I have kind of an opportunity, too, that's unexpected but very instructive. The Washington Metro system, as it runs into town from the east, is above ground. It's in between the train tracks that are running into Washington also. So here are train cars parked on the siding alongside the metro tracks, and you're riding in the morning, you stop at a metro station, and here's a line of tank cars. You look at those things. Those things have a loaded weight of over 200,000 pounds, 100 tons, each car in a line. We're cruising along on the metro. I have no idea what is in those cars, and I probably don't want to know. Those cars carry all kinds of things. Well, what happens if it derails? It's in a residential area. The train tracks go through a residential area into town. Eventually, we go underground. The metro does, but not the freight train. And, you know, they travel along. How does the Prince George's County, Maryland Fire Department or the Prince George's County EMS system prepare for what happens if a train derails? They don't know what is on the tank cars at any given time. They don't know exactly when the train schedules are going through. It's on train time, not watch time for us. They don't know where along the tracks it's going to derail or what else is there. And this is just one event that is typical for so many towns in this country.
You're talking about a single point position. What happens if there's an accident with one of those cars and somebody, say, drives underneath it by accident? It starts leaking in the bottom. The engineer didn't know it, and he takes that train another 10 miles.
Well, exactly. This is all fits into emergency communications and emergency planning, and it makes it a very interesting area, but also a very difficult area.
I just wanted to comment, the scenario that you gave is in ICS 300 and 400, exactly. And in addition to that, the amateur radio operator, the volunteer, the auxiliary communications volunteer now has a wonderful opportunity provided by the Office of Emergency Communications to take a course called OXCOM that will allow them to understand the wonderful process we have now that handles all scenarios of that type in the National Incident Management System, to Incident Command System. In addition, the states are now providing an opportunity through federal funding to allow us as amateurs to mingle with the agencies that we're going to serve through the communications leadership and the communications technical.
Let me ask a quick question related to that, Steve. How many of you have taken 300 or 400? How about the COML, Communications Unit Leader course? That is an outstanding course. It's excellent. I highly recommend it. It'll help you serve your local community.
Gentleman up here, AA5R.
Earlier in the presentation, there was a bullet point that we should strive to be state of the art. We should be good stewards of spectrum. But I would wonder if perhaps there should be some official recognition that one of the MCOM advantages of ham radio operators is that we're not state of the art, that we still use technology that's perhaps more reliable, that's perhaps more like the KISS principle, keep it simple, and that that's one of the reasons why our stuff works when the official stuff doesn't, such as in that fire.
I hear what you're saying, and that is important, and it is very useful. However, you have to look at what is happening today on all the bands throughout the spectrum, not just the amateur radio bands. Remember, carriers are looking for more bandwidth. We have to use what we've got as efficiently as we can, and the only way we can do that today is by being more spectrally efficient with the modulation schemes that we use. But what you're saying is correct, though. You want to use the simple stuff. Keep it simple. Yes, that's great. And that's primarily, though, you're only talking about single sideband for the most part, FM. We're not really talking about digital. Digital is fairly recent in amateur radio's history, and that's where we need to be very spectrally efficient.
You're listening to an excerpt from the 2012 Dayton Hamvention FCC Forum Q&A session featuring FCC spokesman Kurt Bartholomew, N3GQ, and Bill Cross, W3TN. More FCC Q&A in a moment. This is the RAIN Report, available on iTunes.
Word Silver and Zero AX. A lot of new data modes and protocols are coming online. For example, with ROS, you just get a person that invents something and throws it out there, and the general rule is if it's published, you can try it as long as it's compliant with the rules. A lot of these new modes and protocols are very complex, and it's very difficult to assess compliance, and it would be useful if the FCC had some kind of an interface with the compliance officer or a set of guidelines that were published. How can you tell if your data mode or protocol is compliant with the rules and what rules apply to it, so you could go through this process quickly without having to try something and then find out that it was non-compliant?
The amateur service is different than any other service the Commission regulates in that we issue an operator license and we hope and assume that the examination system is sufficient to allow a person to demonstrate that they have a knowledge of communications technology to some extent. What we have in terms of the standards in the amateur rules, primarily at the request of the amateur community, We have the bands that are divided up into essentially a wideband part where you can have the image emissions and phone emissions, and we have a narrowband part, which is the data and the CW and the RIDI portions of the bands. The experimentation part of amateur radio, part of it comes in that we expect that the person that is developing the technology and the people that are developing these systems will be able to determine how they fit within the rules. So that the rules give you a lot of flexibility. It gives you any type of emission you want, well, not any type, but most of them are available, and it allows people to develop the technologies and the modulation schemes and things like that that they want. There is a difference, though, between a modulation scheme and an emission type. Now, in 97.3, we specify the emission types and we categorize those as phone, CW, data, or whatever. What happened with the Ross system, though, is the same thing that happened before, and this shows it works. Someone put something out there, it was new. Other people that are very gifted, very bright, very knowledgeable in this area looked at it and said, wait a minute, this is 7 or 14 discrete frequencies, this is frequency hopping, this is a scheme that you need the keys to it so that you can decode the message, this is spread spectrum, and that's not allowed on HF. So what Ross was doing was perfectly fine in Europe, because in Europe they don't have bands divided between phone and CW the way we do. They either have a maximum bandwidth limitation, or they allow you to use any emission type on any frequency as long as it doesn't cause interference. That's not our system. You may recall a few years ago the ARRL proposed regulation by bandwidth. We received well over 1,000 comments very strongly opposing that, and basically saying, we kind of like having this division of narrowband stuff and wideband stuff, and the single sideband, the voice operators, the slow scan operators were very concerned that if you allow just regulation by bandwidth, there was nothing that would prevent digital from coming up into what had been the phone band, getting on their frequencies, causing interference, and then basically you couldn't communicate with them. You couldn't talk to them and tell them there's a problem here. So the ARRL ended up withdrawing the petition. That kind of left us where we were. To me, this shows the system works. Someone comes up with something, other people look at it with a very jaundiced eye, they examine it, they study it, they kind of break it down, take it apart, and then you see articles in your magazines about this new communication system, how it works. People that are very knowledgeable say, well, this is a data system, or this is a RIDI system, or whatever. And the amateur community then, once they're assured it's rule compliant, they tend to implement it. And we've seen this. We've seen in the digital world things like Olivia. The commission never approved Olivia. We never approved any of the PacTor systems. We never approved GTOR or any of those things. These are systems that have been developed within the amateur community, and they've been rule compliant, and then they've been accepted. ROS was not accepted because it was spread spectrum, and it's like, why do we have spread spectrum on HF? The ARRL took a look at this. The technical staffs looked at it and said, yeah, this is spread spectrum, not allowed. So every once in a while, you see someone come on the air with a U.S. call sign using ROS, and very shortly, the rest of the amateur community corrects them. This is the self-policing aspect of amateur radio. It saves you from being a micromanaged service. It lets you have the flexibility and the experimentation you need to do that.
My name is Mike Lysenko. My call is N2YBB, and I'm the current section manager for New York City and Long Island. Since 1984, since the original PRB1, the league has approached the FCC on numerous occasions to do something about CCNRs. And the FCC, of course, over the years, has consistently said, no, we won't discuss that because it's land use issues and it's contractual issues and we don't get involved in that. Now we have the study where the impediments are geared towards dealing with CCNRs. Is there really any chance that after so many years of not dealing with land use issues that a CCNR situation will be overturned so that people who live in those kinds of environments will be allowed to put up antennas?
The study came about as part of the bill that was involved with the extension of the reduction in the Social Security tax. Congress asked us to make recommendations, and we ask people for input on this. I have looked at a few of the comments as they have come in, and there's input coming from the amateur community both ways. The study, though, is a very broad study. One of the things it asked for was, are there alternatives to having an antenna essentially at a residential facility or in your backyard? What else is there? One comment I looked at said there was remote control. Yes, I live in a CCR community. I have a station outside the area that's remotely controlled. Other people have said there really is no other viable alternative. We need to look at the comments and see what you said before we can really come up with recommendations, because this has been an opportunity for you to kind of come in and tell us what the real world is. And in the past, what we've done is we've looked at this on kind of a case-by-case basis as people coming in with a petition and then ruling on the petition. And the commission made a decision in the 80s about CC&Rs, and they said they were private contractual agreements. Many people have come in and said, well, you've got these little earth stations, these one-meter things, OTARDs, we should apply that. And there's the word, should. They're not saying it does apply. They're saying, we like that answer, please apply it. The commission has said different considerations in that matter. Now we're coming at this thing kind of fresh. And Congress said do a study and make recommendations. The last person I know that predicted what Congress would do, I saw a couple weeks ago sweeping the floor. So I'm not going there. What we will do in the study is, as Congress asked, we will make recommendations. But I have a feeling when I print these out Monday morning, I have this much paper to go through with the comments that have been filed in the docket. And I have a feeling, true to form for the amateur community, there's going to be views on both sides.
Oh, without a doubt.
That's the first of two excerpts from the Q&A session held at the 2012 Dayton Hamvention FCC Forum last month. We'll bring you our fourth and final excerpt from this forum next time. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2012 Rain. All rights reserved. Now for all those connected with the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, bidding you very 73 from the Rain Report. www.therainreport.com